Hello, my name is Jody Lee Mott, and welcome to Dream Gardens, where we talk up the kids' books we love. On this twice-monthly podcast, I interview other kids' books enthusiasts, such as writers, teachers, and librarians, about their own favorite children's books. This podcast's focus today is on Lewis Carroll and his book Alice in Wonderland. And it got me to thinking about another Victorian Englishman with a penchant for nonsense writing, Edward Lear. Lear was born in 1812, and he was an illustrator and a musician who wrote a number of travel books about his excursions throughout Europe as an artist. But these days, we remember him mainly for his collections of nonsense poems for children, poems like The Owl and the Pussycat, and of course his many limericks. And because it seems appropriate for this particular podcast, I'd like to read one of his nonsense poems titled The Jumblies. The Jumblies by Edward Lear. They went to sea in a sieve, they did, in a sieve they went to sea. In spite of all their friends could say, on a winter's morn, on a stormy day, in a sieve they went to sea. And when the sieve turned round and round, and everyone cried, you'll all be drowned, they called aloud, our sieve ain't big, we don't care a button, we don't care a fig, and a sieve will go to sea. Far and few are the lands where the Jumblies live. Their heads are green and their hands are blue, and they went to sea in a sieve. They sailed away in a sieve, they did, in a sieve they sailed so fast, with only a beautiful pea-green veil tied with a ribbon by way of a sail to a small tobacco-pipe mast. And everyone said who saw them go, oh, won't they be soon upset, you know, for the sky is dark and the voyage is long, and happen what may, it's extremely wrong, in a sieve to sail so fast. Far and few are the lands where the Jumblies live. Their heads are green and their hands are blue, and they went to sea in a sieve. The water it soon came in, it did, the water it soon came in. So to keep them dry they wrapped their feet in a pinky paper all folded neat, and they fastened it down with a pin. They passed the night in a crockery jar, and each of them said, how wise we are! Though the sky be dark and the voyage be long, yet we never can think we were rash or wrong, while round in our sieve we spin. Far and few are the lands where the Jumblies live. Their heads are green, their hands are blue, and they went to sea in a sieve. And all night long they sailed away, and when the sun went down, they whistled and warbled a moony song to the echoing sound of a coppery gong in the shade of the mountains brown. O Timbalo, how happy we are when we live in a sieve and a crockery jar, and all night long in the moonlight pale we sail away with a pea-green sail in the shade of the mountains brown. Far and few are the lands where the Jumblies live. Their heads are green and their hands are blue, and they went to sea in a sieve. They sailed to the western sea, they did, to the land all covered with trees, and they bought an owl and a useful cart and a pound of rice and a cranberry tart and a hive of silvery bees. And they bought a pig and some green jackdaws and a lovely monkey with lollipop paws and 40 bottles of Ringbow Ree and no end of Stilton cheese. Far and few are the land where the Jumblies live. Their heads are green and their hands are blue, and they went to sea in a sieve. And in 20 years they all came back, in 20 years or more, and everyone said how tall they've grown, for they've been to the lakes and the Torrible Zone, and the hills of the Chankly Bore. And they drank their health and gave them a feast of dumplings made of beautiful yeast. And everyone said, if we only live, we too will go to a sea in a sieve, to the hills of the Chankly Bore. Far and few are the lands where the Jumblies live. Their heads are green and their hands are blue, and they went to sea in a sieve. My guest today is author C. Lee McKenzie, author of the middle grade fantasy adventure The Sign of the Green Dragon, as well as several YA novels, including Sudden Secrets and Sliding on the Edge. You can find Lee's website at www.cleemckenziebooks.com. Thank you for joining me today, Lee.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Now, as I mentioned, you've written this middle grade fantasy adventure, which is titled The Sign of the Green Dragon. For those who aren't familiar with it, can you give us a little bit of an idea of what it's about?
It's about three boys who discover a skeleton clutching a treasure map. And they set off to trace the story, and they find that they're stumbling on things like an old murder and a modern crime, and then they get to confront some ancient Chinese dragons. So there's a little bit of magic in all of this, too.
And what inspired you to write this story? Where did you get the idea for it?
You know, ages ago, I had read a story about, actually it was a factual story about returning bones to China. It's a tradition, and they're returned to be buried in a certain spot at a certain time based on astrology. And it just stuck in my mind as being something that would be a great thread in a story. So that was the genesis of the story. I just finally got around to writing it a couple of years ago.
Now, you've written for both YA books and middle grade. And I'm just wondering, is the writing experience different for these type of books, or is there a similar process involved?
You know, that's an interesting question. It's very different. I sort of use the middle grade as a, I guess you'd call it the sorbet, because I can have so much fun with it. I'm restricted, of course. I have vocabulary and sentence length and things like that that makes it a little more challenging than the YA. But it's fun to write for middle grade. And I do fantasy and adventure and everything there. I stick with contemporary realistic on my YA. I can't seem to write fantasy for YA very well. I'm not really motivated to do that. I think there's enough fantasy for YA out there. So, but I get the chance to do it for my middle grade. And the process is about the same. I do about the same way, you know, the mechanical part of it. But the fun of it is very different. And I like to do both because it keeps me sort of fresh for both categories.
Now, according to your biography on your website, you've lived in a lot of different places in the world before settling in your current home in California. I'm wondering, has living in these different places influenced your writing in any way, living in these different places throughout the world?
Oh, I think so. Yes, I really do, because I think I have an ear for different sounds. You know, language is different in different cultures and the way people respond in different cultures. I guess that's my background anyway, is linguistics and intercultural communication. So it just added to my awareness of the cultures around the world. And I do think it brings a bigger picture, but I haven't really put it in my books too much. I've sort of kept that in the background, except for like the one that we're talking about now, The Sign of the Green Dragon. That does bring in the Asian culture, which has always fascinated me. And I did live in Southeast Asia, you know, for a while. So, yeah, I have a fascination with that. And I think I'm interested in their mythology, interested in their dragons more than I am in the European dragon, for example, that sort of thing. So, yes, I think it has affected how I write and how I think when I write.
Just a quick question. What is the difference between a European dragon and a more Asian dragon?
That's a great question, because the Asian dragon is a benevolent creature and very intelligent and respected. The emperor would had a five-toed dragon for his insignia. And in the myths, the emperor would consult with the dragons because they were all-knowing and all-seeing and very wise. Nobody went out to slay them. Everybody wanted them on their side. So it's a huge difference. There were no dragon slayers in the Asian dragon world.
The book you chose as one of your favorites is the classic Alice in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll, which was the pseudonym of the British writer and mathematician Charles Dodgson. It was first published in 1865 in England and has remained in print ever since. And it is a very familiar book, I know. I usually ask people to summarize a book, and this is a hard book to try to summarize. But if you want to try to give us an idea of what that book is about.
It's a good question. Yeah, it's episodic, so it's very difficult to summarize it. It's just an adventure of a young girl through this sort of maze of absurd and ridiculous creatures. But the whole point of the book is nonsense. I think that's what people perhaps neglect to understand, that it's a little girl making sense out of nonsense, or trying to anyway. In fact, that's what attracted me to the book, I think, when I was a kid, because I thought, well, here's a young person like me, and she's the one that's sensible in the book. Everybody else is absolutely insane. So that's what it's about. It's nonsense.
Touched upon this a little bit, what drew you to it. What still draws you to this book, still makes it a compelling book for you, both as a young child and as an adult?
Well, probably because now I'm sharing it with kids. I share it with the children in my life. I have lots of nieces and nephews. I've had my own children. And I think that's what keeps it fascinating for me, because each time I share it, it's a new experience. I get different reactions from different children, and some really like it, some really don't. In fact, I had an example where I had one little boy sitting on one side of me and a little girl sitting on the other side, my niece and nephew. And I was reading, I think at this time it was Jabberwocky, which was not Alice in Wonderland. We'd already gone through Alice. And the little boy suddenly said, "Well, this makes no sense at all." And the little girl leaned around me and looked at him and said, "Well, of course not. It's nonsense." And I had never explained that to her. I never brought that up. So I think, well, that's brilliant. These kids really connect with it. So I think that's why I still like it. They connect with the nonsense.
This is a book that's been around for more than a century and a half. It's still in print. It still inspires countless other books, movies, other media. So many other books from that long ago sort of fallen away. And you touched upon this a little bit. What is it about this book that's for so long seems to still hold up, still seems fresh in many ways?
I think because it is so fantastic, the characters, the Cheshire Cat. I mean, can you imagine? I mean, it's always a surprise when you find that there's a grin and there's no cat. Kids are delighted by that. It's just exciting to have that happen. And the cards who fly up in the air and are actually, they're supposed to be gardeners, but they're actually just a deck of cards. And the queen who runs around with a croquet mallet, which happens to be this flamingo. I mean, those kinds of things are totally bizarre to a kid, but that's what they relate to. So I think that's what it, I think year after year, generation after generation, they just relate to this fantasy, this wonderful joy of being free to be crazy, to be nonsensical.
I want to talk a little bit about Alice. We don't really get a lot of her backstory. We sort of get it in little bits and pieces. What do you think you could say about Alice as a character, about who she is, based on what sort of little we find out about her?
Well, Alice is probably laughing because I'm thinking about a conversation with an editor one time that she thought this was a terrible book. And I said, "Well, why?" And she said, "Because Alice has no character arc. She is the same at the end as she started in the beginning." And I said, "Well, then why do you think it's such a popular thing?" And she said, "I don't know, because Alice is a flat character." And I said, "Well, maybe she is, but she does have some emotion during this thing. She just doesn't have any change. So it's hard for me to describe her. She is just Alice, and she's simple. She's straightforward. She doesn't want to play around with this nonsense. She wants things in order, and she can't quite get it there. And that's her struggle from the beginning of the book until the end. And then she's out of it. But she's the same Alice always."
And apart from Alice, you talked about like the Cheshire Cat and other characters. Is there another character or characters that particularly appealed to you or even really appalled you in some way?
Yeah, I didn't like the Duchess at all. I said it was just awful. And I didn't like the Queen. I've never liked the Queen of Hearts at all. But outside of that, I kind of liked the Mad Hatter. I thought he was charming. And I liked the Caterpillar a lot. He seemed to be interesting to me. And I haven't read him, but I liked the Caterpillar.
And apart from the fantasy elements, one of the big appeals of the book, apart from this sort of nonsense element, is this constant wordplay that Carol engages in throughout the book. What do you think that sort of playing around with language and words and what they mean or sort of mean sometimes brings to the book?
Well, I think that's what he loved to do. I think he just loved to fiddle with words. And if I could, I wanted to bring that up actually after I read part of the story. I was going to talk about how he does play with words, and I think it's part of his sense of humor. I think he plays jokes on people, and I think he found joy in making people laugh or think or even maybe stumble because of his wordplay.
And now this novel doesn't, like I've mentioned, it doesn't have a conventional plot. It does have a certain dream logic, and in many ways it's about this young girl's dream. Do you think if it's a dream, do you think we can use it to try to figure out what's going on in Alice's life, or should we even bother about such things, trying to figure things out?
Oh, you mean the what might have been happening in the real Alice? With
Yes.
yeah, I don't think so. I think it was meant to entertain. There's a lot of speculation about Alice and Dodgson, but I just don't think we should go there. I think we should just appreciate it as a story of a dream and have fun with it. I unless you want to get into some analysis and do a term paper or something, I think I'd leave it alone.
This is more of a personal question. If Wonderland was a real place, a place you could actually visit, would you want to actually spend time in Wonderland yourself if you had the chance to?
Oh, absolutely. I'd go in a heartbeat. Absolutely. In fact, I think my boys in this, The Sign of the Green Dragon, they definitely go into a labyrinth of tunnels and things, and they probably was inspired by something that I read years ago, you know, going through this tunnel and finding, you know, adventures. That, yeah, so yeah, sure, I would love to go to Wonderland.
I was wondering your own point of view. Is this just a silly story meant to while away the time? Or is there a message that we can get out of this book? Is it about something in the end that kids can get a message from it?
I don't think it's a message book. I think that it is a book that maybe teaches, if anything, that you can enter a fantastic world, be there, enjoy it. And that, I think, leads people into wanting to read. So I think one of the things that it does in the world, if anything, it makes people want to read and escape like they have with Alice.
You mentioned you had a part of the book picked out that you'd like to share. Would you like to share that now?
Sure. It's the tea party. And the reason I want to share it is what you spoke about earlier, the playing with words that he liked to do. And in this, he brings up the riddle, and I think it's, I think it'll show again what you were getting at about his joy in making people laugh or trick them or think about things differently. Anyway, this is where Alice comes upon a table, and at the table there are three characters: the Mad Hatter, the March Hare, and the Sleeping Dormouse. And here's the part. There was a table set out under a tree in front of the house, and the March Hare and the Hatter were having tea at it. A dormouse was sitting between them, fast asleep, and the other two were using it as a cushion, resting their elbows on it. The table was a large one, but the three were all crowded together at one corner of it. "No room, no room," they cried when they saw Alice coming. "There's plenty of room," said Alice indignantly, and she sat down in a large armchair at one end of the table. "Have some wine," the March Hare said in an encouraging tone. Alice looked all round the table, but there was nothing on it but tea. "I don't see any wine," she remarked. "Oh, there isn't any," said the March Hare. "Well, then it wasn't very civil of you to offer it," said Alice angrily. "Well, it wasn't very civil of you to sit down without being invited," said the March Hare. "Well, I didn't know it was your table," said Alice. "It's laid for a great many more than three." "Your hair wants cutting," said the Hatter. He had been looking at Alice for some time with great curiosity, and this was his first speech. "You should learn not to make personal remarks," Alice said with some severity. "It's very rude." The Hatter opened his eyes very wide on hearing this, but all he said was, "Why is a raven like a writing desk?" "Oh, come, we shall have some fun now," thought Alice. "I'm glad they began asking riddles. I believe I can guess that," she added aloud. "Do you mean that you think you can find out the answer to it?" said the March Hare. "Oh, exactly so," said Alice. "Well, then you should say what you mean," the March Hare went on. "Oh, I do," Alice hastily replied. At least I mean what I say. That's the same thing, you know." "Not the same thing a bit," said the Hatter. "Why, you might just as well say, 'I see what I eat,' is the same thing as 'I eat what I see.'" "You might just as well say," added the March Hare, "that 'I like what I get' is the same thing as 'I get what I like.'" "You might just as well say," added the Dormouse, who seemed to be talking in his sleep, "that 'I breathe when I sleep is the same thing as 'I sleep when I breathe.'" "It is the same thing with you," said the Hatter. And here the conversation dropped, and the party sat silent for a minute, while Alice thought over all she could remember about ravens and writing desks, which wasn't much. So the scene progresses, but here's the end, which gives away some of the nonsense again. Here's the very end of that. "Have you guessed the riddle yet?" the Hatter said, turning to Alice again. No, I give it up, Alice replied. What's the answer? I haven't the slightest idea, said the Hatter. Nor I, said the March Hare. Alice sighed wearily. I think you might do something better with your time, she said, than wasting it asking riddles that have no answers. And in fact, there was no answer to it until the fans of the book started writing to the author asking for the answer. And he created one. There's a whole book written called The Raven and the Writing Desk. And it's about how there should be no answer to the riddle, because that's what nonsense is all about. There's never an answer, because that would be, it would imply forethought. And in a nonsense world, there is no forethought. So, but the answer, do you want to know the answer? Did you know the?
Oh, sure.
Okay.
No, I can't remember. Now, I've heard there was an answer, but I couldn't remember it offhand.
Well, this is what Carroll wrote. He said, the desk is like a raven because it can produce a few notes, though they are very flat. And it is never, and he misspells it, N-E-V-A-R, put with the wrong end in front. Now, when people correct the never and make it N-E-V-E-R, they've lost the joke, because never means raven spelled backwards.
Oh.
It's kind of fun. So, again, that's your, what you brought up earlier. He's playing with the language. He's playing with us.
Well, that's very good. I don't think I've actually heard that one before, Lewis Carroll's own answer. That's very good. Thank you.
It's just kind of a fun thing. Yeah, there's a lot of interesting little story. I started doing the some research on it because I was providing a short story for the anthology called Beware the Little White Rabbit, and we had to kind of, you know, write a story, and I thought, well, I better know a little bit more about the book itself. And I started doing some research, and that's where I started stumbling on some of these interesting facts about the book and the early publishing of it and so forth. This is fascinating.
What story did you come up with, if I may ask?
Oh, yes, it was called, what was it called? My name is Alice. Like, it was now here goes back to your other question. It was an Asian girl from China who'd been adopted. And her name wasn't Alice, but they called her Alice when she was in the United States. And it's their story of coming to terms with being in the United States as an adopted child.
So you took a more realistic fiction.
I did, but I put a lot of the myth in. I put the myth in of the rabbit on the moon. I put that in because there's quite a myth about the goddess who is trapped on the moon, and the only company she has is the rabbit, and I put that in as so it was. And she has a dream sequence where she visits the moon with the rabbit, and then when she returns, she has come to terms with the fact that she's no longer an Asian girl. She's an Asian girl living in the United States.
What is the name of this collection again?
It's called Beware the Little White Rabbit. It has a great cover. The publisher put a great cover on it. It's a GIF. And so it's active, and it's kind of fun.
Well, Lee, thanks for sharing that. And thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me about Alice in Wonderland today. I really appreciate it.
Well, I've had a lot of fun. I never get to talk about this book with anybody anymore. So this has been fun. I've enjoyed it.
You can find C. Lee McKenzie's website at cleemckenziebooks.com. Thank you for joining me on Dream Gardens. The theme music, titled All Together, is provided courtesy of Purple Planet Music. You can visit them at www.purpleplanet.com. Podcast cover art is provided by Creative Pro 180, courtesy of Fiverr, which can be found at www.fiverr.com. You can visit me at jleemott.com or follow me on Twitter at dreamgardensjlm. The Dream Gardens podcast is also available through iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. If you like what you hear, please comment, share, or subscribe. Until next time, keep dreaming, keep growing, and keep reading.